I'd like to convene the Finance Committee. We don't quite have a quorum, so what we'll do is begin with Representative Dill's bill, and Representative Dill, what we'll do is if you would present it, and then if we don't have a quorum present, we'll just lay it over temporarily and take it up when we do have a quorum. So, House File 1940, Airport Funding Advisory Task Force.
Thank you, Chair Carlson, members. This bill creates a short-term task force to study aviation issues across the state that have to do with the 134 general aviation airports that are outside of the Metropolitan Airport Commission. It is to look at the adequacy of current sources of funding for airports in the state, the use of sales tax and its potential use as revenue for airports. Presently, the sales tax dollars are general fund item. The task force is to look at how other airports in other states are funded. We are going to look, this task force would look at the future needs of the state and in terms of aeronautical navigation equipment, airports, infrastructure, and the required investments to complete those future needs. Also, registration taxes on airplanes and how they are registered. And then, of course, any other issues that would come to the interest of the task force that, that surround these issues. And the membership is appointed from the members from the Senate, members from the House, some appointed by the Speaker, one appointed by the Minority Leader. A chairman would be established on page 2, starting on line 1, list the other groups that that may be included in the task force. Those basically represent the airport interest groups across the state in business, in private general aviation, in airport management, the Aviation Trades Organization, and the so on, Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. It talks about that the report from this group is required to be delivered to the legislature, to the chairs of the appropriate committees by February 15, 2008. That would be next February. And it would be anticipated from that there might be possibly legislation that would be changing the formulas and the way things work in terms of aviation funding. Expenses in this group are limited to those of the members of the legislature that are appointed, and that subdivision 4 comes from the interest group saying that they are interested, they will pay their own expenses. And then it has an expiration as soon as the report is submitted, and then an appropriation members of $200,000. And members, this is an appropriation from the state airports fund, the $200,000, and this is in consultation with the Department of Aeronautics. And any remaining funds after the study is complete, after the report has been given to the legislature, will return to the state airports fund. If I could just very briefly give you a rundown, members, I think it's interesting about aircraft and how airports are funded. So I'm going to quickly go through, and it will only take a minute. The first tax enacted on fuel for air aviation needs was in 1945 at 4 cents per gallon. Today, the tax is 5 cents a gallon. So after after almost 40 years, even longer, it was increased in 1983, so it hasn't been increased since 83. It went from 4 cents. After 40 years, it went to 5 cents. And now we are 2007. Aircraft are taxed two different ways in terms of their registration, members. If it is a, in general speaking, if it's a commercial aircraft, it has to do with, such as any of our carriers that are domiciled here out at the Minneapolis airport. They are taxed on the size of the plane, the capacity, the hours of use on the aircraft, which represents depreciation in the terms of an airliner. And then there is a formula for discounts to that for quiet aircraft, ones that meet noise requirements, And also, there is a discount for those that are providing service to rural areas outside of the metro area. In 2005, that tax, the air flight tax is called, again, this is on carriers, like if you got on a flight and flew on Northwest, brought in $7.7 million, and in 2006, it took in $3 million. And the reason for that was the bankruptcy out there. So we are anticipating that that's going to have some relief again. And then the last item is private aircraft. This is something that I think that we need to take a serious look at. Aircraft, there's one company in Minnesota that's looking at a purchase of more than $75 million in aircraft this year, this coming year, to service their business needs. And our tax, of course, is quite high. And our not quite high, is 6.5%, all going to the general fund. And the aviation registration tax on that airplane is 1% of the value. So it's pretty easy to understand that 1% of the value of a $50 million airplane is real expensive. So what I fear is that as the value continues to go up on these aircraft, that those aircraft may be domiciled in other states and where they have very little or no registration tax. However, there is a provision that says if they have the aircraft here more, I think it's more than 60 days, it has to be registered here. That brought in $7.4 million in 2005 and $6.2 million in 2006. That's kind of a rough breakdown of how aviation is funded. Those are the things that this task force will be looking at.
Okay. Still waiting on a quorum, so there is an amendment, but we'll hold on the amendment. And are there questions of Representative Dill about the bill? Representative Westman.
Quick question, Mr. Chair. You said 1% other states or less. Any idea where we sit in the range of states, so Representative Dill, or what are some other states charging, and is there some that don't charge anything?
I'm not prepared to answer that now,
okay.
Mr. Westrom. I know that in Indiana, where I had my aviation business, it was substantially lower than Minnesota when I was in the business.
Sure. Thanks.
Other questions for Representative Dill? Okay, if then we'll proceed, as I mentioned earlier, we'll lay the bill temporarily over, and when we have a quorum, we'll revisit it and then take up the amendment at that time by Representative Junkie.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to stay for that exercise?
Probably best that you do. Hopefully it won't be like the other day, though, where...
I don't have anywhere to go at the moment, but...
Oh, okay.
Other maybe the bathroom, but...
Oh, we have a quorum. Okay, well, very good. So you can stay right where you're at.
Thank you.
And first item we'll do is the minutes, and Representative Rukavina, have you had a chance? You look like you're reading something there.
Mr. Chair, they were lovely. The minutes are absolutely wonderful.
Okay. Representative Rukavina moves the approval of the minutes. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Leader, if you could move the division report.
Mr. Chair, I move the Transportation Policy and Finance Division Report for House File 1940. The first committee engrossment.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Leader, would you
move House File 1940, first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the committee, referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, that motion is before us, and then we have the amendment, Representative Leader.
I move the HD 300 lead-on amendment.
Okay, that motion is before us, and that amendment essentially does what the author described when he was going over the bill. So what it does then is it puts the bill in the form that the author would like the bill to be in. Any discussion on the amendment then, HDA 300? Hearing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. And then we have the amendment that I mentioned earlier by Representative Junkie. Representative Junkie?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've moved the 945 amendment, and I asked staff to make it fit to the DE. I don't know if they want to do that now.
They can maybe do that while we're talking on the amendment.
I think
Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chairman, the only change that's necessary is on line 1.3. It should read page 2 after line 21.
Okay, and that's incorporated then by Representative Junkie into the amendment.
And Mr. Chair, I have another change I'd like to incorporate on lines 1.8 and 1.10, change of 2011 to 2012 on both spots. And I'd incorporate that also.
Okay, everybody have that incorporation? Okay, Representative Junkie.
Thank you, members. And just briefly, Wimmer has recently opened up a brand new airport. Relocated airport about a mile west of where the other airport was, and then just recently officially closed the old airport. State law says that over a period of time, going back as far as you want to go, state dollars that are put into an airport for aviation purposes shall remain for aviation purposes. Over those years, I don't know, back to the 50s, 40s, 30s, whenever they started making, as Representative Dale talked about, the aviation fund, the aeronautics fund, whenever they started making grants to Wilmer, there's been accumulation of about $824,000 of state dollars that have come in there. Now that the airport's closed, of course, that money isn't being used for aviation purposes. What this does is rather than have Wilmer write a check back to the state and we just have to reappropriate it out to the new airport for future projects, this would allow MnDOT to enter into an agreement with the city of Wilmer to keep those funds there as state funds and roll them over, if you will, into the new airport so the city can utilize those funds in the new airport. I've talked to aeronautics about this, and they are fine, but the problem is once the airport was officially closed, they no longer have say over regular, this will be industrial parkland. So this just simply allows them to enter into an agreement with the city of Wilmer for over the next 5 years to use those funds due at the new airport. Actually been agreed to by MnDOT and the city of Wilmer, and I believe the author is okay with putting it on.
Representative Dill, comment?
All of what Representative Junkie has said is true.
I'm not allowing
any blood on
this. Mr. Chair?
Including the reference to the author's acceptance of the amendment.
That is correct.
Okay, that's what I was interested in.
Put your hand in.
Confirming then, Representative Mahoney.
Well, I'll yield to my good friend, Mr. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know.
Representative Rukavina.
And Representative Dill. I realize that Representative Junkie is an honorary member of the Iron Range delegation and is a lot bigger than I am, but the way you bend to him when you don't accept yesterday, hardly even accepted my amendment to your bill, it hurts my heart. It hurts me. Well, you Judas.
Oh, gross,
you have to pay the price in here for previous actions. So, okay, let's say we have Representative Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, you didn't accept my amendment either, and it hurt my heart. Yours at least went on. Representative Junkie, just a clarification question. So is this actual cash that Wilmer has, or is it cash they put into the old airport that they in turn, by selling, will generate cash and put that back into the new airport? Or I'm not quite clear if it's cash you're talking about.
Over the next, Representative Westrum, over the next 5 years, it's their intent. They could do either way. They could put the cash in. If there's a project, for example, they're talking about already extending the runway another 1,000 feet. If they don't get federal dollars, then this probably would be one lump sum that they would expend for that rather than come to the state for it. But more likely is as they sell off parcels in the new industrial park over the next 5 years, that share then that would have come back to the state will then be rolled over into hangar projects or runway projects or other thing, equipment projects at the new airport rather than send the check in here. They can just do it and leave it out there.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, So it's actual cash that they've gotten in the past invested in the prior airport.
Right.
And they'll liquidate it by selling that land that now isn't being an airport anymore. Do we have any... Has this happened in other airports that have closed? Or,
well,
I mean, it seems reasonable, but I'm just kind of thinking what...
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrum, that's the problem. We rarely build a new airport, and I can't remember one in, you know, ever. And there's only a few that are built in the country every year. This is one of them. So this is a fairly unique situation where we totally discontinue use of an airport and have to account for those state dollars over many years. So this really is a unique situation that I don't think the legislature has seen before.
Mr. Chair.
We've got an historian here, though, that could maybe... Representative Leader, any comments about that? Is that Representative Junkie was saying that that's fairly rare that there would be this kind of a land.
Mr. Situation. Chair, that's correct as far as I'm aware, as far as the committee is aware also.
Representative Dill.
It does. This is unusual for to have an airport where it's very, especially it's located right next to the old airport. But it does. There are occasions in the general aviation community around rural cities, particularly rural cities, where a certain amount of land is paid for by federal or state dollars or local dollars and state dollars, however they match up, and is acquired to be a part of an airport property. And then at a later time, there is another use identified, such as a private company that wants to be next to an airport. Of course, it has to be outside of the protection zones. And when that happens, when the city proposes or the county proposes or the owner proposes to sell that land to the private individual to build a development, then they are responsible. As I believe if it's within the 20-year window that they were granted the money, they have to pay back their share or the state's share. And now what has happened, as I can recall in one instance, is that state share was done just like Representative Junkie said. They had future projects that they were working on, so they rolled the state share into the future project. So the aviation community continued to get the benefit of the money.
Okay, any further discussion? Oh, Representative Mahoney, you have Representative Mahoney.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I yielded to my friend, Representative Rukavina, only because he seems so excited, you know, he gets a little agitated. But Representative Junkie, you got a couple of questions. Do you have sales prospects on this particular piece of property now? And how much do you expect to generate from the sale? I mean, often an industrial park is owned by the city or the county or the redevelopment agency or whatever. So I don't know exactly how you're planning to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, or Gentry. First of all, there are some sales pending, one for sure, and probably I think I talked to my city, I think there's two or three others that are in the works right now for that piece of land. So I suspect over the next 5 years, we're out of industrial park area, which is why one of the reasons we're expanding into the airport area in Wilmer. So I suspect the sales will be there. If not, this gives them 5 years. It's about $800,000. This is the state's share, which is 70%. They still have to put another 30% in. So the city essentially has to expend about $1.1 million over the next 5 years total to take this benefit or keep those dollars. And even if there wasn't any sales, they could build it into their budget then at, say, $200,000 a year or something, which would be manageable rather than doing it all in one chunk and then be able to recoup that money over 5 years. And we think that's manageable. So either way, either through the sales of land or building it into their future construction budget, we think it'll be very manageable by the city.
Mr. Chair. And I think I heard you say $800,000 is the expected cash or funds generated. Okay, thank you.
Representative Westrum, I guess you weren't quite done. I didn't realize that. Representative Westrum, you're done? Okay. Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Any further discussion then on the motion by Representative Leader that House File 1940, the first committee engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And We will now go to House File, or Senate File 1186, House File 790, and I'd like to turn the chair over at this point to Representative Saylor. Ready?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that Representative Mahoney would like to move this bill, or the division report, rather.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the Higher Education Workforce Finance Division report for House File 790, Senate File 1186, for the first committee engrossment.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed?
Abstention.
Okay, carried. Get carried away here. I'm ready to go. Pardon? Okay. I'll just move Senate File 1186, second engrossment, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Moe, could you to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the housekeeping bill for the Public Facilities Authority, and I would like to have this bill go to the General Register. It hasn't gone to taxes before, and it has no fiscal note, so it doesn't need to go to Ways and Means. Though, if the chair of the Tax Committee would think otherwise, we can change that motion. But okay,
I'm reading it, so
right.
Okay.
Maybe can we maybe hold off on that? And
Representative Hall,
thank you. This is a housekeeping bill for the Public Facilities Authority. Just a quick review: the Public Facilities Authority is the state-created entity that allows us to do grants to local units of government for phosphorus reduction, TMDLs, rotating road loan program, things like that. As you know, we've passed many changes, clean water legislation lately. This is a technical bill allowing the agency to make the necessary changes to their structure in order to allow us to do TMDL grants that we need to do, phosphorus reduction grants, also to do some clarifying changes to the role of the executive director, Terry Coleman, who is here to answer questions. It's also important to remember that the executive director does answer to a board, and the commissioner of deed is the chair of that board. With that, I would stand for any questions.
Representative Sober.
Madam Chair, maybe we can have Mr. Coleman answer a question. And that is, I notice on 24 and page 24 in that section, and maybe even on 22, that you're doing away with the transportation committee of the board. My concern is on 25, the commissioner of transportation will now be the one who signs off instead of the transportation commission or board, which consists of the Commissioner of Employee Relations and the Commissioner of Finance and Transportation, those three. But my concern is that the adoption of the rules. Will the rules that were adopted by the Transportation Committee continue on with the rules that will be then adopted or implemented by the Commissioner of Transportation?
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg. The only reason we're eliminating the transportation subcommittee is because the projects would go to the subcommittee, which consists of three commissioners, deed, transportation, and finance. And then in order for us to sell bonds, the project would go to the full board, which consists of six state agency commissioners. So we're reviewing it twice. And the subcommittee just said they didn't want to do that and just take all the projects directly to the board. So it's, the rules will remain in place. They're adopted literally by the board. The Department of Transportation has their own rules for reviewing and ranking projects. And the PFA has their rules for looking at the financial viability of the projects and approving it. So everything will remain the same. We're just eliminating the duplication.
And then, I think that's okay about clarification. And I noticed in here where there's a point system for that's being changed for stormwater. Can you tell me a little bit about that? They get 10 extra points.
Yeah. Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that's in Article 2 of the bill on the last two pages. That was a request by the Pollution Control Agency as they just went through a three-year process changing their rules for ranking projects on the PPL. As the TMDL studies were being completed, a lot of issues related to turbidity and things like that, they realized stormwater is much bigger impact on impaired waters. And what this does is when a stormwater impacts or is actually causing an impairment of water, and the city has adopted a plan, it increases the points, so it'd move them up on the list to get those types of stormwater projects in the fundable ways. They'd still be on the lower end of the fundable range when it comes to competing with wastewater, but at least they'd be eligible.
Very good. Thank you.
I think Representative Anderson. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the witness. In Section 2 of the bill on page 2 and 3, we're making some changes regarding staffing and identifying an executive director. Can you explain to me whether those are, whether we're simply codifying what's currently happening, or are we making some changes in terms of the makeup of the Public Facilities Authority? Can you help me understand that?
There is a change, subtle, that is currently the Commissioner of Deed is the one that provides the staff support for the authority. I'm, in essence, the only employee of the authority. What it does is turn the staff over under my control, which, you know, reports to me anyway, and I'm historically always interviewed and hired the staff anyway. And this is, in essence, puts the staff under control of six commissioners versus one commissioner, in essence. So that's one of the reasons for the change. The other reason for the change is the authority is an appropriate entity because we have got bonding authority. And when state agencies, the last two bieniums were shut down, it was always a matter of what do you do with the Public Facilities Authority and its staff, because the obligations we incur go way beyond biennial budget cycles. So this avoids that confusion of what happens. In essence, the staff are part of the authority when the authority is appropriated, so they would still be employed. So that's another reason for the change.
And Madam Chair, so your budget comes through deed? Are you a line item? Explain me quickly.
Okay. how
you're funded.
Appropriated
agency. Mr. Coleman.
The legislature would have to act, in essence, take away the funds.
Okay.
Because we are a bond issuer and we are under contract with the federal government to operate these funds in perpetuity, in order for the state to address that perpetuity concern and the obligation to bondholders, the authority is an appropriate entity. So the funds were self-sufficient. The funds are automatically appropriated annually.
And, Madam Chair, one last question. Mr. Coleman, in Section 3 of the bill, the language related to loans and grants and debt, you've indicated that the authority has the ability to issue bonds. Is this changing anything, this new language here? Is this changing the authority, or is it just recodifying it? Help me understand.
No change.
Mr. Coleman.
Re-clarifying. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. This just rewording it, making it English, I guess, as much as possible. A lot of things are just being relocated and moved around, not necessarily added or subtracted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier on Section 5, Subdivision 8, lines 29 to 32. It looks like we're striking some language regarding, on page 7, we're striking the $4 million cap that's being used for small city block grant program. Can you just provide a little bit of background on that?
Mr. Coleman.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative, when we set up the 9-point source pollution programs with the Department of Ag, Pollution Control Agency, and DEED had two of them, one for tourism loans, and we wanted also the small cities block grant program because they did a lot of housing rehab to deal with septics. They did it 1 year and decided they didn't want to deal with loan programs at all, so we're just deleting that. So it's an experiment that didn't work, so we're just taking it out of statute.
Representative Garofalo.
What the small cities program did was for 1 year they took $1.25 million and they lent it in conjunction with the small cities block grant, which is federal HUD fund, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, to replace septic tanks. And they just found it administratively too burdensome, didn't want to do it anymore. So as funds get repaid, we just put them back into the state revolving fund for municipal wastewater. Just deleting it. So obsolete language.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Representative Lindhast, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And either Representative Mower to your testifier. On page 10 of the bill, subdivision 5B, line 29, you have a special assessment deferral that in current law cities can allow folks to not pay their taxes here, and then you're changing it to governmental units. Can you tell me more about this provision?
Mr. Coleman.
Yes, Madam Chair. In essence, individuals, elderly, handicapped, or municipal governments are allowed to defer assessments to a later date. So if you're putting in a new sewer system, assessments usually run $20,000 to $30,000. Because of the economic hardship in state law, municipalities are allowed to defer those assessments until the property is sold or the person is able to pay. So all this does is make it clear that they can do that with this program.
Representative Lunchowski.
So you're not expanding anything beyond cities?
No. Just clarifying it.
The government
tool, it's
so governmental unit doesn't mean a county or someone other kind of government.
Oh, government
Mr. Coleman.
A lot does mean counties, townships, sanitary sewer districts, municipalities, which is current law as well. We're not expanding the authority to exempt it. We're just clarifying that this program can use that exemption that currently exists in the state law.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, I renew my motion that Senate file 1186 be sent to the General Register. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
What's the extension?
Madam Chair, I might Commissioner McLaughlin, perhaps, and maybe if we could have for available for questions somebody from the library board, we also have representatives here from the city of Minneapolis. We have other commissioners here as well. Madam Chair, to get things started, I'd like to move the House File 1973, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Taxes. And members, this is the bill that's known as the Hennepin County and Minneapolis Library merger. And members, House File 1973 is the policy language that facilitates the merger of the Minneapolis Public Library and the Hennepin County Library System. The appropriations language, some of you may remember, was included then a few weeks ago when the E-12 education omnibus bill passed off the House floor. It is important to note that this is permissive language and it does not require the merger. If combined, the two systems would represent one of the largest and strongest library systems in the country. Representatives of the city and the county have been working to determine the best alternative to enable the Minneapolis and Hennepin County libraries to serve their patrons well and remain on a strong financial footing. These folks have determined that a merged system could be better positioned to address changes needed to substantially strengthen education, learning, literacy, work development, and other community-wide issues throughout Minneapolis and Hennepin County. Consolidating the Minneapolis and Hennepin County library systems will allow our libraries to provide better service to all residents of Hennepin County and remain financially sound. And as I mentioned earlier, I have then representatives with me that can answer questions from the county, the city, and the library board. Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment. I think that was in our packets this morning that deals with some technical changes. So I'd like to move the amendment H19738. One to put the bill in the form that the author would like.
Okay. Representative Carlson moves the H19373A1 amendment. Any discussion? Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Carlson, you're deleting public in your amendment, and yet you leave public in all the other areas regarding to the Minneapolis Public Library or as a definition. What's the purpose of removing public on line 7?
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, this amendment was given to me as a technical update. Ms. Dornfield, do you remember that came from... What's in the charter? Okay. I'm informed that the charter does not use the word public.
For the board.
Okay.
Do we know?
Madam
Chair,
Representative, this was drafted by bond counsel, and I believe it has to do with the fact that in the city charter, the technical name of the library is the Minneapolis Library Board. I believe that's the reason for the amendment.
And Ms. Hadley, could you give your name for the record, please?
Excuse me. Madam Chair, members, I'm Kit Hadley. I'm the director of the Minneapolis Public Library.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. continuing on the amendment, and this was something I looked for as I open the bill. So I think this is probably technical language again, probably from bond counsel, but on line 13 to 15, can you explain how that works? That fits in on page 3 and is related to the debt that the city of Minneapolis had already issued for construction or reconstruction of the library, I believe. Can you explain, is that technical language as well?
Madam Chair, Representative, what page?
Well, it's page 3, but on the amendment, it's line 1.3 to 1.5.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm sorry. I really can't answer that question. This was drafted by bond counsel. These were amendments that they wanted, and
Madam Chair, let me ask this question. Then I understand there was debt issued to pay for the reconstruction, the new Minneapolis Library. I assume that what this is saying is that that debt is going to continue to be the obligation of the city of Minneapolis, is not going to be incurred by the taxpayers of Hennepin County more generally. Is that correct? And is this language just technical to clarify that?
Could you give me your name for the record, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Heather Johnson, Budget Director for the City of Minneapolis. Yes, you're correct in that the referendum will be continue to be borne by the taxpayers of the City of Minneapolis. This amendment does make it technical. The technical change here is that there have been bonds that have been authorized but not yet issued. And so that's just the technical change. And so we want to make sure that that capacity to issue the entire amount of the bonds is still in position.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, so if the additional bonds that have been authorized but not issued are left, is that obligation going to be borne by the City of Minneapolis or by the taxpayers of Hennepin County?
Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the City of Minneapolis.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any further questions, discussion? If not, all in favor of the H1973A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Okay.
We're prepared to take any questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, or maybe for Commissioner McLaughlin, on page 4, and this is kind of along the same vein of the questions I was just asking the city, subdivision D, or subsection D, talks about bonds issued by Hennepin County prior to the merger of the library, the Minneapolis Library and the Hennepin County system, shall be paid by levy of the tax on taxable property within the county outside the City of Minneapolis. My question is that currently what happens with regard to debt related to the Hennepin County library system? Is it paid only by taxpayers in Hennepin County, excluding Minneapolis? So in other words, there are Minneapolis residents off the hook now, and they're going to continue to be off the hook for debt issued previously.
Could you please state your name for the record?
Madam Chair, I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm Hennepin County Commissioner. Madam Chair, Representative Coles. Right now, the capital and the operating costs of the Minneapolis Library are borne by property taxpayers in Minneapolis only, and the Hennepin County system, capital and operating costs, the property tax is borne by the balance of Hennepin County, excluding the City of Minneapolis. So the principle that we've tried to build into this bill is that if there were capital decisions made prior to the merger, they ought to be paid for by the tax base that made the decisions previously. So this would be a main. There was debt that the Hennepin County issued for libraries in the Hennepin County system, and they'll be paid for by the suburban Hennepin County taxpayers, just as the Minneapolis debt is going to be paid for by the Minneapolis taxpayers until those debts are retired.
One last question, Madam Chair. Maybe it's two questions in one, and it's either for Representative probably for Representative Carlson. Can you explain the why behind this bill? Why are we doing this? Is I guess the first part of the question. The second part of the question, Representative Carlson, is anybody opposed to it? Any of the governmental units involved here opposed to it? Are you aware of any opposition to it?
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, the why is to build a stronger system to bring about more efficiency and to hopefully, once this is completed, allow the reopening of three libraries in Minneapolis that were closed at least temporarily due to some fiscal difficulties that they were encountering. When I say a stronger system, there's about $200 million in assets, I think, that the City of Minneapolis has that will be put into the county system. Part of the transition costs that I referenced earlier that came through the K-12 finance system is to the K-12 finance bill is to bring together the technologies so you have a seamless system in terms of the operation of the two systems. They're on different footings in that regard currently. And I don't know if Commissioner McLaughlin would like to add to the why.
Okay. Commissioner McLaughlin.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles. These two systems have operated for decades, and they have operated in a way that's been very complementary. If you look at a spectrum of library services, from popular collection to archival function, where you obtain and keep for access the unique copies of documents and the like, Minneapolis system is on the archival end of that spectrum. The Hennepin County system is on the popular end of that spectrum, and they've operated that way consciously as two systems. We now see a situation in which the Minneapolis system is having difficulties. We also see that this is a regional, frankly, and statewide asset, and that we believe it ought to be supported by a countywide tax base, and it can be done in a way that benefits all taxpayers. Right now, for example, the Minneapolis libraries have the patent library. They have that's used by businesses all over Hennepin County, all over the state of Minnesota. It's closed. It was closed yesterday, Monday. It's closed every Monday because the financial wherewithal to maintain that central resource is not available. So this would provide, we think, in a reasonable way for the two systems to operate together, and it's going to create a stronger library system for business, for the patrons, and we think that the tax burden is distributed fairly if we do that. We think libraries are important. The county board believes in it. The city of Minneapolis believes in it. And in terms of your question about the jurisdictions, the Minneapolis City Council and the mayor, the Minneapolis Library Board, the Hennepin County Library Board, and the Hennepin County Board have all endorsed this concept, and we're working through right now with organized labor on some final details. But the four bodies that have been a party to this merger have all agreed to it, and they have to endorse the final concept once it's put in.
Representative Yarros.
Yes, Madam Chair. And isn't this going to save on administrative costs, too?
Madam Chair, Representative Yarros, yes. We think that there are long-term savings through the combining of the two, through efficiencies in the systems, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. I'm told page five, line four, we need to strike the word public there as well to make it consistent with the earlier amendment, the sharp eyes of Mr. Marks about that. So I'd like to move the amendment.
Right. Representative Carlson moves this oral amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. is this merger, Representative Carlson or Commissioner McLaughlin, what are the overall financial consequences or benefits that you're going to see? I see you're merging the committees and you're going to have a different board and everything. You're talking about trying to be more efficient and effective. What's the overall financial picture of that merger coming together? What do you project? What do you see?
Mr. McLaughlin.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. We think that there in the first year of the merged system, that will be approximately a $200,000 shift from the city tax base to the suburban Hennepin tax base. And that's based on estimates. You had two different assessment appeals that went one way or the other that could disappear. So that's on the order of rounding error. We think out of the chute it's going to be, because of the way this deal is structured, that it's kind of an even up deal at the outset. Ultimately, there is more tax that's shifted to the county, but the tax is going to be borne by the entire countywide tax base, including the city of Minneapolis. So we do not see dramatic shifts, and our budget people have looked at this, city budget people have looked at it. We don't see dramatic shifts in tax burden as a result of this merger. The efficiencies, we think that they're on the order of $700,000 or $800,000. annually by putting the two systems together. This is not a merger. We're talking about two different geographical areas, so we're not talking about you have branch banking or something where you have a duplication and you eliminate some of the outlets. This is talking about two systems that have operated in totally distinct territories, and so we think that in fact the way this is structured, there's going to be a reopening of libraries in the city of Minneapolis, and they'll be able to do that, and the city is being forthcoming in providing the resources to do that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You, on page 9, you reestablish for the first 3 years a board membership. What happens after that, those 3 years are up? What do we have to come back here to reestablish a different board system? Are you going to, or what's reasoning for the way you're doing it?
Commissioner McLaughlin.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. The Hennepin County Library Board is appointed by the Hennepin County Board, and we have never had designated slots for any city. Because of the complexity of the merger and the many issues associated with the merger and the fact that Minneapolis will be a presence, you know, in the system now, and it'll be the biggest city for a temporary period. 3 years, we're going to guarantee that there will be slots for Minneapolis. But once that temporary period is over, we would revert to our former policy where all appointments would be open. It's still, we found that that system is a better way to make appointments rather than having designated slots. And frankly, it was a hard concession for the county board to make to even provide for the temporary guarantee for the first 3 years.
Thank you, Mayor.
Representative Anderson. Is that it? Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A few questions. Getting back to the question, if I understood you right, the efficiency or what seems to be gained in savings is predicted about $700,000 to $800,000. What's the budget of the Hennepin County Library and the Minneapolis Library systems right now?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner McLaughlin,
Representative Westrom, it's $43 million is the budget of the Hennepin County system and $20 million in is the Minneapolis system.
Representative Westrom.
40 and 23, I beg your pardon, not
40 and 23.
40 and 23, yes.
So where do you think the $700,000 to $800,000 of savings will come, and is that all you can save by merging, or how do you save money, I guess? What do you think will bring forth the efficiency?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, if I can bring up the library directors, they can speak to this point better than I hope.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Amy Ryan, Director of Hennepin County Library. Madam, Mr. Chair, Representative, when we think about operational efficiencies by merging the two major systems, the use of our systems is growing. So we aren't necessarily going to save money, but we will redeploy some of the savings. We both have, for instance, HR departments. Other duplicative services are our finance departments. How we acquire materials, there'll be operational efficiencies in the cataloging and the materials handling of the two libraries. As Commissioner McLaughlin said, we aren't going to save money by closing libraries, but we will put our best thinking together to make a premier library system by merging the best of both systems.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Westrom.
Whichever, maybe Commissioner McLaughlin, but do you have any other city-run libraries in Hennepin County, or does Hennepin County run all the other libraries excluding Minneapolis?
Hennepin County Library has 26 libraries throughout the county. We run all of the suburban libraries.
And
Representative
so,
Westrom.
Madam Chair, Ms. Ryan, essentially this will, all the libraries in Hennepin County will now be Hennepin County Libraries, in Minneapolis just won't have their own anymore.
Ms. Ryan.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Is there a last question, I think, Madam Chair?
Westrom.
Is there a pay differential between the two library systems right now? Is is one higher than the other? And if so, is that, I mean, well, answer that one first, I guess.
Okay.
Ms. Ryan.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there is a pay differential in what's estimated to be that impacts negatively up to about 50 people.
And who's the higher paid?
The Minneapolis Public Library has a higher wage rate in a few classifications than Hennepin County Library.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Ryan, which system is more financially unstable right now?
Ms. Ryan.
Hennepin County Library has a stable financial base.
And Minneapolis Library does not?
Madam Chair, Representative, Minneapolis Public Library is struggling financially, and because of that, they have closed three libraries temporarily. And they, it's my understanding from the Minneapolis Library Board that they are not in structural financial balance over the long term. Hennepin County is economically strong and stable at the...
So, Madam Chair, that's getting just a little deeper than I thought it was going to, but Ms. Ryan, and is one of the savings that maybe you're going to level off the wages with the Hennepin County system instead? I would assume that's a big portion of library costs is labor as well.
If they're
paying that much extra in wages, is that contributing to the problem, or is the Hennepin County system now going to raise all their wages to what Minneapolis was doing? If so, is that just going to lead to a financially unstable county system rather than just the city system?
Mr. McLaughlin.
Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
We need to maybe clarify a couple of things here. The cost of the wage differences is going to be covered by the City of Minneapolis. The City Council has agreed to do that. But I think an important footnote on this is that you have a different history of collective bargaining in the two systems, and to look at just the wage differentiation between the two systems is only part of the picture. There's, for example, in Hennepin County, some retirement benefits that Minneapolis librarians do not have. And so there are differences, but the difference on the wage side is going to be covered by the City Council, and they've agreed to do that. One of the things that's under discussion right now is putting in place a process to resolve some of those issues. And in fact, there's a meeting coming up this Friday, I think, between the unions, the county board will be present, I think, as well as the library board and the city council to fine-tune how some of that's going to be handled.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I guess where I'm going with this concern is, what is the plan? Oftentimes, and we find that with nursing home reimbursements, hospital reimbursements, is you've got high-cost centers, and in this case, that appears to be the one that's financially unstable. And if we're going to merge a lower-cost center into either help bail this system out, or try to make it stronger going forward, my concern is we aren't going to... If the Hennepin County system is going to be pulled up to the model of Minneapolis, and I can see the workers in the suburban libraries may say, hey, Minneapolis is getting paid X amount more than we have been getting paid. We're going to bargain for that wage or go on strike. Are we not just setting up a larger system now that's going to have a more expensive financial model and cost the taxpayers even more money? Or has this been resolved so there's a middle ground found, or the Hennepin County model will prevail and Minneapolis will have to just suck it up in order to continue a strong future or how are they going to resolve this? Because merging them and just going back, buying into the Minneapolis model might not be a very prudent process or way to go for the taxpayers and the system as a whole.
Ms. Hadley.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's not accurate to say that overall the economic package at Minneapolis costs more than at Hennepin County. There's been a lot of focus on the wages. The actual wage differential at this point, the current estimate, is about $300,000. This is not a major factor. And the whole issue of the value of the difference in the value of the benefit package in some ways hasn't really been quantified. But I don't think anyone connected with this would say that the economic package overall at Minneapolis is richer than in Hennepin County. There are a number of benefits that are more generous at Hennepin County and therefore more expensive than at Minneapolis. There has been, quite rightly, focus on the wage issue, and that needs to be addressed. But it isn't accurate to say that the model overall is richer over at Minneapolis.
All right. Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Hearing none, Representative Carlson, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 1973, the first endorsement, be recommended to pass as amended. And re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay. All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Referred to taxes.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.